Earl Warren seemed friendly, but rather dull. He was also a novice, having been appointed Chief Justice of the United States only 6 months before. President Dwight Eisenhower assumed that Warren would be a safe, docile conservative. Instead, the new Chief Justice dropped one of the biggest bombshells in American legal history. The case was officially called Brown et al. Versus Board of Education of Topeka et al. Public education in cities like Topeka, Kansas, was segregated, with the separation of pupils into white and black schools justified under an 1896 Supreme Court decision, Plessy versus Ferguson. This decreed that segregation wasn't discriminatory, providing the facilities were separate but equal. After lengthy legal argument, Warren read out the court's decision on Monday, May the 17th, 1954.
Does segregation of children in public schools solely on the basis of race, even though the physical facilities and other tangible factors may be equal, deprive the children of the minority group of equal educational opportunities? We believe that it does. To separate them from others of similar age and qualification solely because of their race generates a feeling of inferiority as to their status in the community that may affect their hearts and minds in a way unlikely ever to be undone. We conclude that in the field of public education, the doctrine of separate but equal has no place. Separate educational facilities are inherently unequal.
The outcome of the Brown case polarized opinion. The Washington Post, invoking words from Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, claimed,
"It is not too much to speak of the court's decision as a new birth of freedom. It comes at a juncture in the affairs of mankind where this reaffirmation of basic human values is likely to have a wonderfully tonic effect."
But Judge Tom Brady of Mississippi declared that May the 17th, 1954, should be known henceforth as Black Monday.
Black Monday is indeed symbolic of the date. Black denoting darkness and terror. Black signifying the absence of light and wisdom. Black embodying grief, destruction, and death.
Brady's language about freedom and blackness expressed the sentiments of millions of white Southerners, as the Supreme Court was well aware. Having decreed that segregated schools were unconstitutional in principle, Warren and his colleagues then decided not to force the pace of change. They didn't demand immediate desegregation or even set a timetable for implementation, but simply instructed that schools be desegregated with all deliberate speed. This left the issue up to the Southern political elite. So black Americans took matters into their own hands.
We shall.
One of the most visible marks of their social inferiority in the South was the practice on buses of requiring black passengers to enter by the rear door, and when the bus became crowded, to move to the back or stand. On the evening of December the 1st, 1955, in Montgomery, Alabama, a woman called Rosa Parks decided not to budge. As she recalled later,
"When the driver saw that I was still sitting there, he asked if I was going to stand up. I told him no, I wasn't. He said, 'Well, if you don't stand up, I'm going to have you arrested.' I told him to go on and have me arrested."
Rosa Parks was duly taken to jail. Local black leaders decided to make her a test case. Married, middle-aged, and a steady churchgoer, she would be a perfect symbol. On the day of her trial, they arranged a boycott of Montgomery's city buses. Joe Asbell, a reporter for the local paper, described what happened.
"At 5:30 a.m. today, the big yellow buses of the Montgomery City lines began pulling into Court Square to pick up passengers. Generally, a swarm of Negro passengers are waiting at the stop for the buses to take them to private homes, laundries, factories, and jobs throughout the city. As the first bus arrived, the driver noticed a sign tacked to the wall at the bus shed. "Remember, it is for our cause that you do not ride the bus today." A policeman tore down the poster and took it to police headquarters. Negroes were on almost every corner in the downtown area, silent, waiting for rides or moving about to keep warm. But few got on buses. Negro cabs were packed tight, and it seemed as if they stopped to pick up more passengers at every corner. Scores of Negroes were walking, their lunches in brown paper sacks under their arms. None spoke to white people. They exchanged little talk among themselves. It was an event almost solemn.
The bus boycott had been intended as a one-day affair, but its success emboldened black leaders. At a meeting that evening, they formed the Montgomery Improvement Association to keep the boycott going. Joe Asbell recalled the mood.
"I was about 2 minutes late coming in, and they were preaching, and that audience was so on fire. The preacher would get up and say, 'Do you want your freedom?' And they would say, 'Yeah, yeah, I want my freedom.'"
According to Joanne Robinson, another activist,
"I don't know if there was one vote that said, 'No, don't continue.' They had been touched by the persecution, the humiliation that many of them had endured on buses."
The meeting elected as the movement's leader a new young black minister who stood outside the factions that fractured the city's black elite. Martin Luther King Jr. was the son of a famous Baptist preacher from Atlanta with a PhD in theology from Boston University. Pushed into the breach at short notice that December evening in 1955, the studious 26-year-old clergyman showed a rare talent for leadership. Fred Shuttlesworth, a fellow minister, never forgot his impact.
"Dr. King spoke with a new voice. Not only was it a new movement, but it was a new voice that you must love. You must not hate the people who hate you or act like they hate you, and the best thing you can make out of your enemy is a friend. So this had a very profound effect on not only blacks, but whites at this time."
When a bomb shattered the front of his house, King still preached forgiveness and nonviolence. When he and other black leaders were prosecuted, they queued up for jail, milking the nationwide publicity. The boycott was now beginning to pinch the city, particularly the bus company and downtown businesses. Eventually, a case against segregated buses made its way up the federal courts, and in November 1956, the Supreme Court declared Montgomery's practices unconstitutional. Community leader Rufus Lewis recalled,
"The blacks got on a bus to sit on the front seat just to show off. And they had a lot of fun sitting on the front seat riding. Riding to the college or riding away from the college. Nobody sat in the back then, because all of them sat in the front. It was a jubilation. It was a joy."
Bus boycotts spread to other cities in the South, but change was piecemeal and white resistance hardened. In September 1957, the governor of Arkansas blocked school integration in that state, warning that otherwise blood will run in the streets. He brought in the National Guard to keep black students out of white-only schools in Little Rock, the state capital. Elizabeth Eckford, age 15, was one of nine black children who set off for Central High at the start of term on September the 4th. Years later, she recalled that day.
"I approached the guards. I had seen them break ranks to admit students. When they saw me, they closed ranks. Now, Central is two blocks wide, and I was thinking to myself, maybe I'm not supposed to enter here. So I walked further down the block where there was another sidewalk approach to the school. And this time the soldiers crossed rifles to bar me. They directed me across the street. I was angry, voices screaming at me. And they surged forward so I couldn't go back in the direction I came.
You got an opportunity now to get away from here. If you wish. If you don't, you better get out of here. You better clear out. You're going to turn these hoes on you without..."
After weeks of harassment and violence, President Eisenhower felt obliged to send in the U.S. Army to keep order. The sight of paratroopers from the 101st Airborne Division, vanguard of the army that brought freedom to France in 1944, now protecting black schoolchildren in America, was richly symbolic. Daisy Bates, editor of the local black newspaper, recalled the soldiers arriving to escort the 9 black students to school.
An army station wagon stopped in front of our house, while photographers perched precariously on top of cars and rooftops went into action. The paratrooper in charge of the detail started up our driveway. As he approached, I heard Minnie Jean say gleefully, "Oh, look at them. They're so soldierly. It gives you goose pimples to look at them." And then she added solemnly, "For the first time in my life, I feel like an American citizen."
But in Little Rock, as in Montgomery, the battle for desegregation was long drawn out. All through the school year, the token black students at Central High were subject to persistent harassment. One of them, Ernest Green, recalled a defining moment just before Christmas.
"For a couple of weeks, there had been a number of white kids following us, continuously calling us niggers. Nigger, nigger, nigger. One right after the other. Minnie Jean Brown was in a lunch line with me, and there was this white kid who was shorter than Minnie. He reminded me of a small dog yelping at somebody's leg. Well, Minnie had just picked up her chili. She turned around and took that chili and just dumped it on the dude's head."
For a moment, there was total silence in the school cafeteria. Yeah.
And then the help, all black, broke into applause. And the white kids there didn't know what to do. It was the first time that anybody had seen somebody black retaliate.
Minnie Jean Brown was suspended and then expelled. Her family moved to New York, but the other students struggled through the year to receive their graduating diplomas. That was a symbolic victory for blacks, but segregationists called Graduation Day Liberation Day because the school was finally free of black students. For all the following year, Little Rock's public schools were kept closed rather than allow blacks in again. They reopened only after another Supreme Court decision forced them to. Montgomery, Alabama, and Little Rock, Arkansas, were signs that the fabric of segregation was finally beginning to tear across the Deep South. Pressures from the Supreme Court, newly attentive to racial issues, and from local black citizens ready to stand up for their rights were having an effect. But it was all painfully slow. Socially, African Americans were still at the back of the bus. It would take a new generation with new methods to make real breakthroughs.